welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell with ESPN. It is Wednesday, March 27th, 2019. We have an audio show for you today. We have a lot to discuss when it comes to the National Football League. A little later on, we're going to talk about the Jets and talk about running backs on the whole and which running backs might be likely to improve or decline in 2019 with our friend Chase Stewart. But first, the big news of the week, obviously, Rob Gronkowski's retirement. A little unexpected, at least to me, but I'm going to talk to someone who is very qualified to discuss this topic and what's going to happen to the 2019 Patriots, and that is our friend Doug Kide from Nesson. Doug, how are you?
I am doing very well, and yeah, it was pretty surprising news, even though it did feel like this news had been coming for about 14 months.
Right, like it was one of those things where you kind of figured it was going to happen, but you didn't know if it was going to happen this week. And even when I read about Jared Cook, you remember reading about the Jared Cook negotiations and sort of when he decided to sign with the Saints, it had sort of become, you know, the hint was that, oh, well, this means Rob Gronkowski might be playing for the Patriots in 2019, or it might seem perhaps more likely that we're going to see Gronk play for the Patriots in 2019. But then several days later, even before Jared Cook is officially signed with the New Orleans Saints, Rob Gronkowski has retired. So, I mean, heading into the offseason, if I asked you to peg the chances of Gronk suiting up in 2019, what would you have put them at, just knowing what you saw from him in 2018?
I probably, right after the Super Bowl, maybe I would have put it at like a 45-55 chance that he would have come back. But then, you know, every week that he didn't make the announcement, once free agency had started, once we got this late in the process, I think it kind of shifted over to the other side of maybe 55-45 of a Gronk coming back, just because, you know, it had been a while since the Super Bowl at that point, and you would have thought that the Patriots would have kind of pushed him along to this decision a little bit earlier than last week. But from Drew Rosenhaus's timeline, it seems like Bill Belichick called Drew Rosenhaus on Thursday to say, hey, can we get a decision from Gronk pretty soon here? And then 3 days later, Gronk did make that decision. But yeah, I mean, just the fact that it opened up $9 million worth of cap room that the Patriots didn't have before, and prior to having that cap room available, the Patriots were making some maybe desperation moves is a, you know, maybe too harsh of a way to put it, but they were making moves that they usually wouldn't do to open up more cap space just to be able to, you know, have some freedom during the signing period.
Yeah, I mean, they restructured Stephon Gilmore's contract.
Yeah, and that's something they usually don't do. I mean, they converted his base salary into a signing bonus, and that really ensures that Gilmore will be around at least this year and next year, and maybe even into 2021 as well, which might not be that big of a surprise since Gilmore was a first-team All-Pro this year, but that is a move that they usually don't make to push cap hits down the line like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they're probably, I would say outside of maybe the Bengals, who have a lot of cap space every year because they don't spend a lot of money. Like in terms of perennially competitive teams, I think they're the least likely team to make that move and restructure a contract and push more money into the future. They tend to be very, very prudent and very, very sort of in the moment in how they deal with the salary cap. So it's very surprising. And I think it's very surprising because it feels like so often – we think of Bill Belichick as this guy who is so, he's several steps ahead of us. He's always, you know, two moves ahead. He always knows what's going to happen next, and he's anticipating that and heading in a different direction. And with this, it kind of felt like, you know, they didn't really have a great idea of what was going on. It kind of felt like they had to, you know, react on the fly and sort of prepare for different opportunities and then, you know, end up with a roster that certainly I think is still going to be very competitive and they're still going to be a great team, but, you know, is going to miss Gronk. Do you think if Gronk had retired in 3 days after the Super Bowl, do you think they make more of an effort to add talent to this roster when it comes to receivers during the free agent period?
I think that it's possible they could have been more involved in, you know, some sort of Odell Beckham trade or, you know, it seems like, based on the podcast that Antonio Brown released, it seems like the Patriots were involved in the potential Antonio Brown trade talks. Maybe they would have been a little bit more aggressive in that way. But the two players that they seem to be, or there was a few players there where they were really tied into, and that was Adam Humphries, who they were offering more than $9 million a year to.
Wow.
Cole Beasley, Jared Cook. Jared Cook wind up getting paid a ton by the Saints. I'm not, I mean, if they were already offering Adam Humphries more than $9 million a year, I can't see them offering him even more than that to sign in New England. That just wouldn't have been a smart move at that point. So it really seems like, based on the offers that they were giving guys, the players that they were in on, it seems like they, Gronk's retirement or his lack of retirement really didn't seem to affect them that much in the free agency period. They just weren't willing to spend up to what other teams were when it came to Jared Cook or when it came to Cole Beasley or it came to some of these other receivers. They were with Adam Humphries. Unfortunately for them, they were a little bit late on that, where Adam Humphries had already committed to the Tennessee Titans. But just the fact that they were able or were willing to go back to Humphries and say, all right, we'll give you more than the Titans, I think that does say that they were still willing to spend money and that they really weren't all that hampered by Gronk's indecision at that point.
Yeah, and what I think is so fascinating about their current situation is, okay, you lose Gronk, and there's no replacing Gronk. Even if you sign Adam Humphries, you sign Jared Cook, they're not Rob Gronkowski, obviously. And at tight end, they also cut Dwayne Allen. So now they're down their top two tight ends from last season. Chris Hogan is a free agent. Philip Dorsett, I believe, re-signed, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. Philip Dorsett re-signed, but then Cordarrelle Patterson left. This is a receiving core that is dramatically different from even what we saw a year ago. And then we're also entering the final year of Julian Edelman's contract. And Julian Edelman, of course, was great during the Super Bowl, won MVP, but he's 32, a guy who the Patriots, typically they don't tend to keep guys around into their mid to late 30s at skill positions. It depends on the price tag, obviously, but there's a chance that Julian Edelman might not be on the roster next year either, I think. And I think there's a better chance than maybe it would be for most other players in his position, but there's still a chance that, you know, we could see a totally different receiving core than even the group we've seen over the past year or two. And even that group has not necessarily always been, you know, the 2007 Patriots in terms of receiver depth either.
Right. There's definitely a lot of uncertainty around that position. It seems like there probably will be a pretty big youth movement in the draft. They've got 12 draft picks. Six of those come in the first three rounds. So I do expect them to take maybe multiple tight ends, multiple wide receivers in this year's draft. And that sounds great on paper to be taking these guys for high picks, but the Patriots have not had a lot of success under Tom Brady and Bill Belichick as far as rookie wide receivers go. There's really been four successful rookie wide receivers, and I use that term pretty loosely, mm-hmm. and it's been Deion Branch, Malcolm Mitchell, and then you're getting down to guys like Aaron Dobson and Kenrell Tompkins. Mm-hmm. No one else has really succeeded as a rookie receiver in this system, so even if you do take, say, a wide receiver with that 32nd overall pick, there's no guarantee that that player will succeed right away. And maybe that'll work down the road when, like you're saying, guys like Julian Edelman are off their deal and Philip Dorsett only signed a one-year deal, so he could be gone after this year. But you really do need to shift your focus a little bit more towards this year, too, because after Julian Edelman, I mean, Philip Dorsett couldn't pass Chris Hogan on the depth chart last year. When they had Philip Dorsett as their number three last season, they had to trade for Josh Gordon. So I think that tells you pretty much all you need to know about Philip Dorsett. I think he could be a number three or four receiver in the Patriots system, but mm-hmm. you don't want him to be your number two. And then beyond him, you're talking about guys like Braxton Berrios, who didn't play last year, mm-hmm. Maurice Harris, who wasn't even tendered as a restricted free agent by the Washington Redskins, and Bruce Ellington, who was cut by the Detroit Lions mm-hmm. in February. So you're really reaching the bottom of the barrel as far as the Patriots wide receiver depth chart goes mm-hmm. when you get to their number three receiver. So a lot of work here needs to be done. I still think there could be a trade down the road, either mm-hmm. at tight end or wide receiver. It's hard to kind of, you know, see who those players would be at this point. Maybe Tampa Bay would be willing to give up one of their tight ends. Maybe the Giants would be willing to ship out another wide receiver. Everyone brings up A.J. Green, but I don't know where that ever stemmed from. I don't think there was any report that said that A.J. Green was available for a trade. I think that people are kind of putting pieces together there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be great to have A.J. Green, but who knows if the Bengals even want to trade him.
Yeah, that's like the I'm running the Patriots in Madden, and I want a wide receiver, right. So I'm just going to trade for A.J. Green without the Bengals thinking, oh, why does this trade make sense for us? Oh, you actually mentioned Malcolm Mitchell, who you'd figure, you know, as recently as January was talking about possibly coming back and wanting to play for the Patriots and then ended up retiring, I believe last week, obviously kind of lost in the shuffle of the Gronk news. Are you surprised they haven't tried to bring Chris Hogan back?
I am a little surprised by that. I think that some of that has to do with a family situation with Chris Hogan, and that's mm-hmm. that his wife is she works in the medical field. I don't know if she's a nurse or a doctor or whatever she is, but she works in Long Island. So last season, Chris Hogan would play on Sunday and then drive down to Long Island and then come back for Wednesday after home games. And that kind of worked for a season, even though Chris Hogan had a fairly disappointing season for what the expectations were. But I really do feel like for Chris Hogan, it would be much easier if he did play for one of those New York teams, whether it was the Giants or Jets. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if one of those teams doesn't want to sign him or if he can't reach an agreement, you're better off being with the Patriots than you are with, say, the Seattle Seahawks. But I do think that there might be some other elements in play there as far as Chris Hogan's free agency goes, just as far as him being in a comfortable situation with his family. And I mean, it did seem like, I don't want to get into Chris Hogan's head, but it did seem like some of his issues last season were maybe mental issues. Him and Tom Brady weren't on the same page, or maybe Chris Hogan was getting frustrated that he wasn't getting targeted enough. So it wasn't a perfect situation there last year. At the same time, you'd much rather have Chris Hogan as your number three receiver, number two receiver, than you would to have Bruce Ellington or Maurice Harris.
Can I say something I'm going to regret, Doug?
Yes, I'll allow
that. Okay, so if the Patriots can use a private plane to fly down to Florida for, I'll just say, sketchy stuff in Florida, they couldn't get like a helicopter to take Chris Hogan from Patriots games on Sunday to Long Island in like a much shorter period of time than a car?
To be honest, actually, I don't know. Maybe he was flying. Maybe he was flying commercial. I don't think there was any sort of private jet or helicopter situation. Would have been nice, but, you know, it's the whole Patriot way where no player is bigger than any other player. So I don't know. It's a very good question, Bill. And Robert Kraft does seem a little busy right now, but when he has a chance, maybe I'll ask him that question.
Do you also, by the way, do you believe that the decision to not have the Patriots play the opening game of the 2019 NFL season is based on the NFL not wanting the story of that game to be about Robert Kraft?
I didn't actually really think of that, because didn't actually those reports that it was going to be the Packers and Bears come out before the Kraft news
did? I feel like it did, but then in the immediate sort of Twitterverse after that story, it was, oh, well, the reason they're doing this, obviously, is to avoid Robert Kraft conversations on the national television.
There's all these conspiracies surrounding the Robert Kraft thing, because there's also people were talking about how maybe Rob Gronkowski announced his retirement on the Sunday before the NFL annual meeting, because the Patriots didn't want Robert Kraft to be the big storyline of the NFL annual meeting. So there's all these conspiracies. I'm not sure if any of them really add up. I think that really all they are coincidences. It is a little strange that the opening night game is going to be the Packers and Bears. I suppose it does add up with the whole NFL 100 thing. And I'm sure that Bill Belichick, even though he wouldn't say this at the NFL annual meeting yesterday, I'm sure he's not complaining about this, because every time they do have that Thursday night game, he does kind of complain about it a little bit, just because that gives the Patriots such a short timeline after their final preseason game to get all their moves done, cut players, bring in new players, adjust their depth chart, get the team practiced before their week one game. So I don't think that him or the Patriots organization really cares maybe as much as some Patriots fans do about this.
Yeah, it does seem like it's not that important of a thing. But even more so, like, the thing I don't understand is this. It's not as if the Patriots are going to be on primetime television a bunch. They are every year. That will be the case again this year. It's not like in week three, you know, if the Patriots are on national television, that the Robert Kraft thing isn't going to be a story. Like, that 2-week difference is not going to be, you know, the point where we'll all forget about the Robert Kraft situation.
Yeah, certainly not. And I think that some of the timing of, you know, even Kraft's trial will play into this a little bit. I have no idea when that's even going to be. I mean, if that was going to be in early September, then yeah, maybe that would affect things. But I'm not even sure if Kraft knows when his trial is going to be. I think to some degree, obviously, this story will carry on. By the start of the NFL season, there might be some, you know, Kraft fatigue by that point. Obviously, people are going to want to talk about it, but I can't imagine that playing into it at all with the NFL scheduling that game. Because like you said, I mean, anytime the Patriots are on national TV, that is going to be a storyline. It's going to be brought up, and it's going to be brought up whether they're playing on Thursday night or Sunday night too.
All right, Doug. Well, let's talk about Rob Gronkowski's place in Patriots lore and whether he's a first ballot Hall of Famer after the break here. But first, I want to talk about our friends at SeatGeek. Now, I would like to think that if Rob Gronkowski was to make a comeback to the NFL, maybe he would get in touch with SeatGeek. It would become Seat Gronk for a week. But at this point, we don't know if Gronk's coming back. So if you're a Patriots fan, you might want to hit the road and check out some other teams next year. I think they're going to be fine. I think the Patriots are going to do just fine without Rob Gronkowski. They've managed to survive guys in the past, but you may want to see some other guys. This might be your last chance to see a player who you're not expecting to retire. So if I were you, if I was someone who wanted to go check out, for example, a baseball team during the offseason, maybe not focus so much on the Patriots, maybe not be so dependent on Gronk, I would go and speak with our friends at SeatGeek. And maybe speak to them is the wrong word, but I would go to their website, because you can search for any ticket to any event pretty much on the planet. If you need to get tickets to get into an event, SeatGeek has them on their website, because they are going all around. They are rating tickets using their DealScore technology. They are aggregating them onto their own website, and then they're giving you the best possible deal. And they're only going and working with reliable sites, so your purchase is fully guaranteed. So you can shop for any ticket you want on SeatGeek with total confidence. And again, whether it's the Major League Baseball season, whether it's the National Football League, whether it's the NHL or NBA playoffs that are both coming up, MLS, MMA, boxing, anything that you need a ticket for, you can get it on SeatGeek. Wherever I go on my phone, I go to the SeatGeek app, I look and see what's available. Hey, if I want to go to a game, I go to a game. I was in England last week. I went to the England Czech Republic match. I looked on SeatGeek. That's the first place I went. And I would highly recommend you download that app to your phone. And if you haven't used it before, you can get $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase by going to the SeatGeek app and at checkout, entering in promo code Barnwell, my last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L, promo code Barnwell for $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase today. SeatGeek, life's an event. We have the tickets. Now back to the show. So in terms of Gronk, in terms of the big picture, his legacy when it comes to the Patriots, is he a first ballot Hall of Famer for you?
Yeah, I think it's actually kind of crazy that, and I'm sorry if you hold this opinion, but I do think it's kind of crazy that people came out and said, whoa, 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 cool the Jets on Rob Gronkowski being a first ballot Hall of Famer, because it's just a lot of the times, and this might be kind of dumb on my part, but a lot of the time with a Hall of Fame, it just comes down to feel for me, mm-hmm. as far as whether a guy is a Hall of Famer or not. And obviously there's other elements in play, but all of those elements kind of play into the feel situation. And Rob Gronkowski's been the best tight end in the NFL almost since he came into the league. I know he's had the injuries. I know that he wasn't the most durable guy, but when he was on the field, he was absolutely the most dominant tight end in the league. He's possibly the most dominant tight end of all time. Perhaps there's a case to be made for, you know, someone with more longevity like Tony Gonzalez being the best tight end of all time. But even if he's not the best tight end of all time, he's in the conversation. And if he's in the conversation for that, he absolutely should be a first ballot Hall of Famer. Obviously, at the same time, we're talking about a institution that didn't let Terrell Owens be a first ballot Hall of Famer. So anything still could happen, but he's absolutely deserving to me.
I think that's the tough part, though. I think in terms of talent and in terms of impact, absolutely he's a Hall of Famer to me. You know, and the point you made about he's, you know, if I asked you from 2011 until this past year, who is the best tight end in football? Generally, the answer was going to be Gronk. There might have been stretches here or there, or because of injury, you'd say, okay, well, maybe Travis Kelce or Jason Witten or somebody. I don't know. But I mean, the vast majority of that time, he was the guy. But, you know, I don't think I would put him in first ballot, but I do think there is something to the idea of, okay, well, he missed a chunk of time in over the past 7 years. He only played, I think he hasn't played a full 16 game season since 2011. And then there were a couple times he sat in a week 17 game, but I mean, he's missed significant time over the last six seasons, and he's retiring after what, nine seasons in the NFL, where you have someone like a Tony Gonzalez, who was a high end, you know, again, if not the best tight end, top two, top three tight end, for 16 years as a starter. I mean, there's a whole second career there. So, you know, I guess I see both sides of it. You know, I would put him in, but I think, I don't know that I think it's as much of a slam dunk as you do.
Interesting. I mean, some of this, to some degree, obviously is biased because I'm covering the team. I'm in the region. Mm-hmm. Everyone treats Rob Gronkowski like he is the best tight end of all time. And he's basically been treated like that ever since his second year when he had that monster sophomore season in 2011 when he had 1,300 yards and 17 touchdowns. I do think that what plays into it a little bit for me is that basically, despite the injuries, mm-hmm. if you divide Gronk's total yards by his number of seasons, so he still averaged 873 yards per season, and that's despite the fact they did miss so many games. Well, Tony Gonzalez averaged 890 mm-hmm. yards per season, and he basically never missed any time whatsoever. So right. he was still basically putting up the same production on a per-season basis as Tony Gonzalez, despite missing all that time. So I don't know. I mean, I think that if Barry Sanders is a first ballot Hall of Famer, if Calvin Johnson's a first ballot Hall of Famer, obviously their careers were different because they didn't have as many injuries, but it mm-hmm. was a shortened situation there. I think that Rob Gronkowski is too. I suppose, like I said, I mean, Terrell Owens wasn't a first ballot Hall of Famer, so anything could still happen. But if I'm voting, then I'm putting him in there.
In terms of, and I think I talked about this with you actually on a show earlier this year, in terms of where he stands within this Patriots dynasty that's going on for, 20 years now almost, is he the third guy you think of after Brady and Belichick?
Yeah, probably. I mean, he's the second best player, I think, of this, this massive Patriots dynasty at this point. It would have to go Brady, then Gronk. Then you've got kind of a solid chunk in there where you're talking about the, Vince Wilfork and Willie McGinnis and Richard mm-hmm. Seymour and Ty Law and all those guys. But no, I think that he probably will be the third guy that people think of. I think that as he's, like I said, he's the second best player, but I think there have been guys throughout the dynasty who've probably made a similar impact on mm-hmm. the Patriots dynasty because, I mean, Rob Gronkowski was only on the field for two Super Bowl wins. And I know right. I say only, like that's not some massive accomplishment, but he wasn't on the field when the Patriots won Super Bowl 51. It was Martellus Bennett, tight end. Gronkowski was injured. He was on injured reserve for that game. Mm-hmm. So I think that does take away maybe a little bit from where he stands in Patriots lore, but just given the talent, just given the upside, just given the dominance that he had, he's still the second best player of this dynasty.
Is there anyone else you think of, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, from the Patriots, from this 18-year run, that you would think, oh, they're, if not a first ballot Hall of Famer, likely to be a Hall of Famer based on what we've seen so far?
I mean, Ty Law made in the Hall of Fame. I think that Richard Seymour should be, but obviously mm-hmm. he's not first ballot since he's still not in there. I think it's possible that, Vince Wilfork gets in there eventually, but I certainly don't think that he'll be a first ballot. Then there's, the guys like Randy Moss or Darrell Revis who weren't, long-tenured Patriots. But they are probably, the first ballot guy for Darrell Revis, I would assume. But no, it is very interesting when you kind of break down the Patriots dynasty. It's a lot of guys who are in that kind of Teddy Bruschi or Julian Edelman range. And the Julian Edelman Hall of Fame conversation is a whole different conversation. But guys who would not traditionally be Hall of Fame players. And you're even talking about guys like Willie McGinnis in that group, too, mm-hmm. and Vince Wilfork, if he never makes it, where very solid players maybe made two or three Pro Bowls or two or three All-Pros, but weren't considered among the best players at their position in their generation. So, yeah, and I quite honestly, I probably would have thrown Ty Law into that group as well. Obviously, mm-hmm. he did make the Hall of Fame, but I didn't think that that was as clear-cut as some Patriots fans do. I think he was a very good cornerback. I don't think that he was necessarily ever in the conversation for best cornerback of his era. He was in the top five, but probably wasn't beating out Charles Woodson or Champ Bailey during any portion of his career. And that falls in line, like I said, with a lot of those other guys who were part of this Patriots dynasty.
Right. Yeah. I think there's a lot of Hall of very good guys there, but not necessarily a ton of Hall of Famers. Nothing to do with their talent. Just, I think that they were regarded, especially early in this dynasty run, as just as like they were the team. It was always about the team, not the players. So, again, I could see, like you said, Vince Wilfork getting in wouldn't shock me. I wouldn't be horrified. I think he, is a deserving player and an incredible defensive tackle. But you know, a guy who didn't rack up many stats. And at the end of the day, the Hall of Fame, unfairly, I think it's fair to say, as someone who really wants a lot more offensive linemen to get into the Hall of Fame, tends to be a organization that rewards stats and rewards lots of Pro Bowls and All-Pro appearances. So it could be tough.
One other guy who actually I didn't mention, but two others actually who deserve mention. I think it's possible that Wes Welker gets in the Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. I don't think he will. I'm not sure if he necessarily deserves to. But I do think that he could be in the conversation. And the other one is Logan Mankins, who is in that very bizarre range of Patriots, the Patriots dynasty, where he played from 2005 to 2013 and managed to not win a Super Bowl with the team. But he was a seven-time Pro Bowler. He was a first-team All-Pro in 2010. He was a five-time second-team All-Pro. So just based alone off of that, off his Pro Bowls and All-Pros, and the level of play that he was playing at throughout his career, he probably should be a Hall of Famer. But the fact that he wasn't on a Super Bowl team that won, I think could maybe take away from him a little bit.
Actually, the guy who we're forgetting about is Adam Vinatieri.
Oh, Adam Vinatieri too. Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, I'm not sure if it's first ballot, but he'll get in eventually. And what's kind of funny is that as far as being on the Patriots goes, Steven Gostkowski might actually be a better Patriots kicker than Adam Vinatieri, mm-hmm. but he didn't have as many big moments that you can point to.
Actually, now that you bring up Gostkowski, are you surprised he's not signed at the moment?
I'm very surprised by that. I think that they did need to clear this cap space. I think that now that Rob Gronkowski is retired, I think it increases the chances that he will come back. Just because he wasn't going to play for free. He wasn't going to play on a contract like Ryan Allen or anything. So I think he probably will be in that, you know, $4 million range. And I actually just wanted to bring up another player as well, and that's Josh Gordon. Mm-hmm. Because we were talking about tight ends and wide receivers so much, and I feel like I kind of failed to mention him. Mm-hmm. I think that Patriots fans should go into the 2019 season with as low of expectations for Josh Gordon as humanly possible. Treat him as if he's not on the roster. Anything that you get from him is gravy. It's almost similar to Rob Gronkowski, where if Rob Gronkowski comes back with three games left in the season, great. If Josh Gordon plays at any point of the 2019 season, that's great, but you can't count on him, and you have to construct a wide receiver depth chart as if you are not going to have that guy at all, just because of what has gone on throughout his career and the fact that he was on this team last year. He lasted 12 games or 11 games, and then it didn't work out. I think that that's probably, unfortunately, what might happen if he does come back for 2019 as well.
Mm-hmm. You actually set up my final question, Doug. So I know Rob Gronkowski has said he's not coming back. Drew Rosenhaus has thought otherwise and said otherwise that, you know, if Tom Brady needs him, Gronk will answer the call. Whether it's based on total speculation, whether it's based on your information, whether it's based on your gut, what percentage chance do you think there is that Rob Gronkowski plays at least one game for the Patriots during the 2019 season?
I'll go with like 40%, and I don't know if that seems high or low.
That seems high.
I guess so. I mean, because I did a podcast this week with Zach Cox, who's our other NSN.com Patriots beat reporter, and he thinks it's a higher than 50% chance that Gronk comes back. So I'm on the lower end scale of this, but I don't know. I mean, say the Patriots are 6-5, 6-6, something like that after 12 games. I do feel like Tom Brady will be in Rob Gronkowski's ear about coming back. I'm not sure what the benefit is for Rob Gronkowski to do that, unless he just misses football. I think that injuries have to play into this as well. A guy who has a ton of injuries throughout his career, coming back at midseason after not going through training camp and OTAs and minicamp and all that stuff, seems a little bit dangerous. But just the fact that Drew Rosenhaus is hinting so heavily about this, the fact that William McGinnis was talking about it weeks ago before Rob Gronkowski even retired, he put this idea in everyone's head. I think there's got to be something there. So I really would not be surprised. At the same time, I do put it at a less than 50% chance that he comes back.
Interesting. We will see. But Mr. Kide, where can people check out more of your Patriots coverage?
You can go to NESN.com to check out all of our Patriots coverage. Follow me on Twitter at Doug Kide, Instagram on at Doug Kide. And we do the NESN Patriots podcast. So find that on iTunes.
All right, Doug, thanks so much. We're going to come back after the break here, talk some Jets and some NFL running backs with Chase Stewart here on the Bill Barnwell Show. All right, back here on the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm still Bill Barnwell of ESPN. I am joined by another AFC East correspondent, perhaps someone who covers the league as a whole, but someone whose opinion I am interested in, not only as a great analyst who writes for Football Perspective, his site, but also at his heart, a Jets fan. It is a frequent contributor to the show, Chase Stewart. Chase, how are you?
Bill, thanks for having me on. And yes, my heart is still here after all these years.
Well, given that you've waited so long for a appealing Jets, maybe not that one, but certainly even at their best, perhaps over the past 20 or 30 years, this has not always been the most exciting offense when it comes to the Jets. When the Jets have been successful, it's generally been a defensive side of the ball, mostly a little bit of offense here or there. Are you excited about what we're going to see from the Jets in 2019 after they've added so much in free agency?
I think so. Is that the right answer? You know, I think they've done on paper what they could have done. They hired a coach with an offensive background in Adam Gase. And, you know, there are lots of things you could say about the hiring, but he is a guy with an offensive background. Mm-hmm. They added the best offensive free agent available in Le'Veon Bell. They did add a wide receiver in Jameson Crowder, who I think is pretty complimentary to what the Jets do and should help. And you've got a young quarterback in Sam Darnold, who's now going into his second season. I think he is expected to play better. He certainly had an up-and-down rookie year. Mm-hmm. The offensive line is still a little bit of a work in process, but you know they did a pretty good job doing what they could to make this a better. I mean, I guess they could have traded for Odell Beckham, but other than that, they did a pretty good job.
I think Dave Gettleman wanted to get rid of Odell Beckham. I don't know if he would have been willing to get rid of Odell Beckham to the Jets. I think that would have been a real tough sell to his fan base.
I don't think he cares about his fan base, but you're right. So I think, you know, the Jets did a pretty good job retooling the offense. You know, they didn't sign a center, which a lot of people expected them to do. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, there's obviously still a draft to come. I think they've done what they could, and now it's time to see if all those pieces can turn into something.
Now, that's the fan perspective. From the analyst side of you, are you happy with these signings? Do you think they represent fair value? Are you excited about the idea of paying a running back like Le'Veon Bell, what amounts to, what, $12, $13 million a year guaranteed for the next couple of seasons? Does that all fit right for you in terms of how you might want to build a football team?
I think it's as good as you can do. You know, these are not the sort of decisions you make in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. If you're building an NFL roster in an alternative universe, you probably wouldn't do it this way. But if you place yourself as GM of the Jets on January 1st, I think it makes sense. They ended up paying less for Le'Veon Bell than most people thought. Mm-hmm. It's not a crippling contract by any means. Teams often, you know, waste $5, $10 million a year on players who are not deserving that. So paying a little bit more for a guy who should be at the centerpiece of the offense, I think it is a good deal. In general, running backs don't tend to differentiate themselves all that much, and paying any one running back doesn't seem to be a worthwhile investment. But there was no star player really anywhere else on offense that was available for the Jets to add. So I think that made sense. And with Sam Darnold, he was not good as a rookie. He mm-hmm. played well at the end of the year, but that's a really small sample. And so I think as an analyst, let's say you have to be cautiously optimistic, but there's a lot that needs to happen before you can say, yeah, the Jets are going to be good on offense. And Adam Gase, while we've seen him, you know, oversee some great offenses, he certainly is capable of overseeing bad offenses.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think the Dolphins offense with Jay Cutler was not ideal. What I find interesting about Gase, and I've written about this on Twitter, got Dolphins fans very angry, and I don't understand why, because they've watched the Dolphins play over the past few years. He really hasn't been able to solve his running back situation. A few years ago, it was, let's give Sutton Anderson an offer sheet. That got declined. Okay, let's sign Arian Foster. That's not working out. Let's rotate four different backs from series to series. They settled on Jay Ajayi. Jay Ajayi had a great end to the season. He was the starter. Then midway through that year, Ajayi suddenly a problem in the locker room. They trade Ajayi, who wins the Super Bowl. They turn it to Kenyon Drake. Kenyon Drake looks very good. They signed Frank Gore in the offseason, all offseason, and say, hey, we're going to split carries. Fans say, oh, no, of course not. Kenyon Drake is going to be a top five running back. Look who good he was in the second half of last season. And then they split the carries. Frank Gore got a bigger chunk of the carries. I think in touches it was about 55-45. But, I mean, he has been a guy who it seems like has not been able to settle on a running back or a running back rotation or really found any sort of consistency. But those running games have relatively been pretty good. So I find it interesting that they're going to basically now be with Le'Veon Bell. He's going to be their guy. Obviously, I think Elijah McGuire will get a few carries here or there. They could draft a second back to give them some depth, but I mean, you don't sign Le'Veon Bell unless you're planning on giving him, you know, 20, 25 touches a game. That's what you do when you pay a guy that much money. So, I'm intrigued to see how this offense works with Le'Veon Bell, what kind of role he plays. I think about the Giants, for example, with say Quan Barkley, the numbers at the end of the year are what they are, and we'll get to them in a minute, but, you know, so much of what he did was just basically act as a safety valve to Eli Manning where, oh, nobody's open? Okay, let's just check it down and let's see if Saquon can make a couple guys miss or, oh, we didn't account for that blitz or that offensive lineman got burnt, so let's just, you know, dump it off to Saquon and we'll figure it out later. You know, I wonder if Adam Gase is going to make Le'Veon a really fundamental part of this offense in the passing game or if he's just going to be that sort of screen and drop-off guy.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be an interesting situation to watch. And, you know, all the teams in Florida seem to have problems with running backs and figuring out how to properly invest in that position. And there's no question Gase was not able to get a consistent running game going around one player, and he didn't seem to have a real philosophy. Mm-hmm. It changed often. And some of that may just be because of his issues as a head coach. So he had some personality issues with players, and that mm-hmm. may continue in New York. I do think it may be a good thing for him to not have to think about it. This is sort of one thing to take off the list. Mm-hmm. I don't have to worry about my running back now. Let me worry about X, Y, and Z. Because this, to me, feels a lot like when the Jets signed Curtis Martin a couple of decades ago. It was, this is the guy. He's the workhorse. You know, Le'Veon Bell was a real outlier mm-hmm. in being a workhorse. That is more of a 2003 NFL than 2018 NFL, which Le'Veon Bell missed. And I think you're going to see the Jets focus the offense around Bell when it comes to both screens and running. But, you know, if the Jets had three great wide receivers, I would say this is not a, you know, a fit that's a little more, you know, hard to justify. Mm-hmm. This offense will revolve around Le'Veon Bell because he is by far the best player on the offense.
It's very true. It's funny you bring up Curtis Martin because you think about him and, you know, I guarantee I was 13 when he signed with the Jets. But if I had been an NFL analyst, I would have been sitting here saying, oh, well, you can't go after a running back. He was a restricted free agent, if I'm not mistaken. You know, he had 14 touchdowns his first two seasons. It's great. That's not sustainable. He's already got a ton of tread on his carries. And then he was effective. He wasn't always great, but he was certainly the focus of that offense for 8 years and played at a high level, was a all pro his next to last season in the NFL. I mean, he was a phenomenal football player, and the Jets were totally vindicated in making the decision they made to acquire him from the Patriots. So, I mean, there's a chance the Le'Veon Bell deal could work out, even if it's not necessarily what I would do with the money or what would work in most cases. It could work in this case. And I think certainly, you know, I think the point you made that I really agree with is that there wasn't anyone similar to Le'Veon Bell out there in the marketplace. There wasn't a wide receiver who was equivalent to Le'Veon Bell in terms of his ability, or a tight end who was equivalent to Le'Veon Bell in his ability. And, you know, would I want to pay Le'Veon Bell $13 million a year in a vacuum? No, I would not. I'm not going to lie. Would I rather pay Le'Veon $13 million a year or give, Devin Funchess, I think, what, 10 and a half going up to 13 a year from the Colts, or Jared Cook, $8 million a year, in the first year of his 2 year, I think $16 million deal is where it's coming in. I would rather pay Le'Veon Bell. I think he's a better player. And I think that he's a, you know, someone who's going to make Sam Darnold's life easier than either of those guys would make Sam Darnold's life.
And, you know, when you talk about the question of, is this going to work out? It's an interesting question as to how would you measure whether or not this works out. Is it individual success by Bell? Is it the efficiency numbers that Bell does or doesn't put up? Is it quantity, or is it how the offense operates? And so, you know, from my perspective, I think Bell will absolutely, when healthy, have the numbers from a quantity perspective. Mm-hmm. He will have touches. He will be a favorite to lead the league in touches. But I think really the way I would look at this signing is, how does the Jets offense work? And does he make life easier for Sam Darnold? Does he help reduce, you know, the pressure that gets placed on a receiver like Quincy Enunwa or Robbie Anderson, who maybe isn't a top receiver, but it gives them more room to operate along with the Crowder? If the Jets end up having a top 10 offense, and, you know, I can't, it's hard to imagine that without Le'Veon Bell having great numbers. Mm-hmm. But if, even if that happened, I think that would still make this a successful signing, because this is, you know, the way Bell wanted to be paid is not just a running back. I think you analyze this decision of, how does the Jets offense look with Le'Veon Bell in it?
Yeah. And I think the guy we haven't talked about, it could play the biggest role in all of this, perhaps, is Kelechi Osemele, who they traded for, giving up basically a swap of picks with the Raiders, a guy who, you know, was, if not the best guard in football 2 years ago, certainly in the discussion. I mean, certainly in the top two or three. And then 2017, their scheme didn't really fit what he wanted to do. He wasn't 100%, and the injuries kind of slowed him last year. So a couple of years removed from him being that caliber of player. But, I mean, he's 29. He turns 30 in June. A guy who, you know, even in 2017, even though he wasn't the guy he was in 2016, was still a way above average guard. I mean, you know, if he's a all-pro caliber offensive lineman, then suddenly you have a guy who can create holes for Le'Veon Bell, and you have a guy where even if you don't solve the center situation, even if you don't have a above average center, you know, you have a guy who's going to make the center's life easier regardless of who he is.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate the optimism. I guess my initial inclination is the Raiders traded him for a reason. Mm-hmm. I don't think his salary cap number was that exorbitant. And so, he absolutely at his peak was that sort of player. He is not, you know, he wasn't last year. Will he be in 2019? Certainly we don't know that. If he does, the Jets got a great deal, but I think you can't expect that. And the Jets didn't have to give up much to get him. It's possible that the Raiders didn't know what they were doing, but I'd say the hope is he's an improvement and an upgrade at the position, and a starting caliber above average guard would be great. Returning to his all-pro form, yeah, I mean, that would be an absolute home run for the Jets and for Bell.
I have to admit, I was not expecting to hear well, I mean, the Raiders did it, so they must know what they're talking about, argument on the podcast. But hey, I mean, what's the Khalil Mack trade just won best trade of the year at Sloan, right?
I mean, you know, you never know what could happen with the Raiders. It's a new year, Bill.
It's a new year, it's true. Let me finish with this in terms of the Jets' perspective. If they were going to add one player to this offense in the draft who was going to be a week one starter, would you want it to be a center? Would you prefer a tight end? Would you want a player at a different position? Or is it just basically a center or a bust for the Jets in the draft this year?
Yeah, I think that's probably the area where an average player would give them the most improvement. You know, tight end, it could be anywhere, whether it's tight end, another wide receiver. The Jets just are still in the mode where they need to add talent. Mm-hmm. They have a bunch of solid players now. But, you know, so you're able to move from below average to average, that helps. But anywhere where they can add talent, I think you have to draft for, you know, best player available rather than need, with a slight preference for a center.
So you're saying they should draft another quarterback?
You know, stranger things have happened.
That would be pretty strange. All right, Chase, well, I want to talk about running backs on the whole and some running backs who might improve or decline in 2019 in a moment. Let's talk about ZipRecruiter first, because I don't know what policies the Jets use to go out and try and get players. They have scouts, I would assume. They have coaches. They have Mike McCagnan, their general manager. They probably could have saved some money by just using our pals at ZipRecruiter, because ZipRecruiter makes hiring people simpler. If you have a job that you want to fill at your company, you can go post on a bunch of other places, spend all day posting it on 10 or 20 different places. It's a waste of time. You have better things to do with your life, and you want to be more productive. ZipRecruiter lets all of that happen, and ZipRecruiter is so effective at that that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. Think about that. You could be posting this job right now. Maybe you're listening to the show in the middle of the afternoon. Maybe you're listening to it at 2 in the morning. Within the first day, you can get a qualified, quality candidate to that job. And it's very simple. Just by going to ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell, you can post your job on over 100 of the web's leading job boards. And even better than the thing I said was even better a minute ago, ZipRecruiter is scanning thousands of resumes once you post that job to find the right candidate with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. If you're a Jets fan, you know you have not always had players who had the right experience for the jobs they were being asked to play for with the New York Football Jets. So if they'd used ZipRecruiter in the past, maybe we wouldn't have had that season with Browning Nagel at quarterback. Maybe we would have had a qualified candidate quarterback in years past, and now they do with Sam Darnold, but he can still use help, and the Jets could still use ZipRecruiter. And you, right now, my listener, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. My last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L, ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now back to the show. In terms of running backs, we talked about Le'Veon Bell a bit. I brought up Saquon Barkley. Around this time of year every year, or at least at some point during the offseason every year, you'd run one of my favorite series of the year at Football Perspective and looking at running backs and looking at what I believe is maybe your least favorite stat. I'm not 100% sure, but certainly in the discussion for your least favorite statistics is yards per carry. Why is yards per carry such a bad stat?
Well, it's more overrated than bad, but it really just doesn't tell you that much, and that's the problem. So I think it's overrated because people think that it tells you much or it gives you a lot of insight, but it really doesn't because yards per carry is really skewed by long runs, and long runs are a reflection of skill and a reflection of luck, and they're also pretty inconsistent from year to year. And when you add in something that has a bit of luck to it, is not typically all that repeatable, and has such a huge weight on a metric, it really just devalues that metric. And so I don't want to evaluate a running back by yards per carry. I'd rather look at all of their carries and get a sense of how they're doing. So I've created what I call heat maps on my website where I'm looking at how often does a running back get at least 1 yard, positive yards, how often does it get 2 yards, 3 yards, squares, and so on. And then you can see a player who has a 5.0 yards per carry average could be much worse at gaining all of those amount of yards than a player with a 4.2 yards per carry average just because of a few long runs. And long runs are great. We love them. They're fantastic. Mm-hmm. But they are not as valuable as consistently gaining yards because football is a game of first downs. The goal is to consistently move the chains. Gaining yards is obviously really important, but not all yards are created equally. We know that. A yard on 3rd and 1 is a lot more valuable than a yard on 3rd and 20. And so being able to consistently gain yards is more important than the yards you gain after you already have a first down.
Now, you mentioned a running back who averaged 5 yards per carry, who wasn't quite as effective as a running back who did not average 5 yards per carry. I know that was just a hypothetical, but is there a back in the 2018 NFL season who was widely celebrated and maybe won an award who might qualify as a player who yards per carry perhaps inflates his level of play a year ago?
There just might be, Bill. And so, you know, I like Saquon Barkley a lot. I went to Penn State. I enjoyed watching him. Mm-hmm. I was excited that when he got drafted. I think he's fun to watch. And, you know, another thing to think about, all running statistics are simply a reflection of how a running back performed. It doesn't mean it's the running back's credit or his fault. Mm-hmm. You know, they play in an offense behind an offensive line. But yes, statistically, Saquon Barkley underwhelmed almost every single time he ran the ball, other than the 6 or 7% of the time when he broke off a huge run. Mm-hmm. And so his yards per carry was really inflated, and there's sort of no other way to say it than it was really inflated. He ended up having 3 runs of 68 yards or more, mm-hmm. and then 3 more runs of 50 yards or more, and a 7th run that was for 46 yards. So those are great plays, fantastic runs, but he also was one of the worst players in the NFL at gaining at least 3 yards on a carry. One of the worst running backs in the NFL gaining at least 4 yards on a carry. So you kind of picture those stats and you get the sense of a player who was really boom or bust, and a 5.0 yards per carry average makes you think he was really good, and I think it's misleading to say he was really productive last year. On an efficiency basis, he was really productive from a quantity perspective, But he was not productive on an efficiency basis because he had so many below average runs.
Now, let me play devil's advocate, because I obviously have no reason to support Saquon Barkley or get in his corner. I'm not biased here in the slightest. But in terms of, you know, you watch Saquon Barkley play, you're going to sit there and say, wow, this guy is a transcendent back. Look how often he makes that first guy miss. He's so fast. It's, you know, his acceleration is incredible. He's a specimen. You know, he's the exact sort of player you would figure is going to break the rules and surpass, surpass whatever regression to the mean you might expect from a guy who's not going to have those big carries. Had there been backs in the past where historically that's been true, where they've been able to sort of buck those trends and make up for those missing 1, 2, 3, 4 yard runs by racking up 50 plus yard runs over and over and over again?
Not really. And so I think the question I'd ask is, if you're going to say everything you said, then are you going to bet on one out of every 40 Saquon Barkley runs being a long game and one out of every 60 runs being a 50 yard game? I don't think you're going to. And, you know, this is not necessarily a knock on Saquon Barkley. I do think being precise is important in what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. What the specific comment is that Saquon Barkley's 5.0 yards per carry average significantly overstates how effective he was on a carry-to-carry basis. He could be a great running back, and if he had a 4.2 yards per carry average because on two of his long runs they got called back because of a holding penalty, mm-hmm. it wouldn't change how good Barkley was or wasn't last year, but I think it would significantly change the perception we have. And that's kind of the point, is that those two or three plays, so many things can happen that would cause them to happen or to not happen, and when they have such an outsized weight on one statistic, mm-hmm. it makes me not want to put a lot of weight in that statistic. So if you want to tell me Saquon Barkley's great because you watch him and you think he's great, I'd agree with you. Mm-hmm. If you want to say he's great because he had a 5.0 yards per carry average this year, that's where I disagree with you.
Mm-hmm. So what's the flip side of this? Is there a player whose yards per carry was not especially impressive a year ago, but when you look at the efficiency numbers on a play-by-play basis, he's someone who really impresses you, or someone who stands out as a guy who was better than perhaps his yards per carry figure seems to indicate?
Yeah, and, you know, it's a good question. You know, one thing to keep in mind is last year yards per carry averages were through the roof. And so mm-hmm. what's a bad yards per carry average is hard to really comprehend for anybody who's been paying attention to football statistics for a long time, because it really was a record-breaking season. But mm-hmm. what you'd want to, you know, look at are players who were consistently gaining yards but didn't have a lot of long carries. Todd Gurley is actually one of those, and he played behind a great offensive line. I think he really benefited from that. Mm-hmm. Alvin Kamara is a pretty interesting example, because you talk about, you know, can't Saquon Barkley continue to have great long runs? Well, that was Kamara as a rookie. And last year, his yards per carry was 4.55, which was only a little bit above average, mm-hmm. which, you know, maybe it'd be surprising. He didn't have the long run that you would have expected. You know, he actually only had one run that was more than 18 yards.
Wow.
But the fact that he still averaged 4.55 yards per carry shows that he was consistently gaining yards, and he was. He really did a great job. He was above average at gaining 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 yards than everybody else. So he was really good at that, but his yards per carry was capped because he didn't have the big runs. A few other players were, I would say, fortunate to be in a system, and, you know, and all numbers are part of the system. Somebody like Gus Edwards or Mike Davis, I think they benefited from playing with mobile quarterbacks, but they were excellent at gaining positive yards. I don't know if that's necessarily just because of their ability or because of the quarterbacks they play with, but, you know, noteworthy that they were really good at gaining yards, and so was Aaron Jones, although Jones also led the league in yards per carry, so he's not really flying under the radar.
Right. On the flip side of this, is there a back who we would expect to be good, who typically has good numbers or is typically an effective player, but just for whatever reason didn't have many long runs last year, and someone you might expect to improve given a more, you know, traditional rate of big runs in 2019?
Kamara is certainly one. I could say Sony Michel would, you know, be in that category as well, which probably scared everybody who's not a Patriots fan, which probably most people. You know, a lot of the running backs who are able to gain 4 or 5 yards, that's the where I typically look to see is who's doing a good job in those numbers. And again, somebody like Gurley, he still had a good yards per carry average, but it wasn't what it could have been. Mm-hmm. Philip Lindsay also was really good at consistently gaining yards, but he had a great yards per carry average But I think it would be the guys like Gus Edwards, even Frank Gore. You know, it's an interesting example of a, obviously, you know, the oldest running back around. He still was gaining yards 7-8% better than the average running back up until a certain number. So he doesn't have the long distance ability anymore, mm-hmm. but he was really effective last year, even at the age of 68.
There's a guy who stands up to me as a candidate to improve in 2019. It's David Johnson, who, I mean, pretty much below average, you know, in just about every facet outside of getting, you know, got 1 yard more frequently than a lot of backs. But I mean, a guy who didn't have many big runs last year per the chart here on Football Perspective. But a guy who we saw in 2017, he can be a good running back. He can certainly make a lot of big plays. So, he's the guy who stands out to me as maybe someone who you would figure better offensive line is going to help a bit, maybe get him through, you know, some of those runs where he's not, you know, he's getting bottled up at the line of scrimmage, maybe a better scheme. But someone who you'd figure is going to maybe take a step forward just on breaking off two or three more big runs than he had a year ago.
Absolutely. I mean, he was in such a tough situation last year. It's hard to imagine a worse situation for a running back playing behind not only the league's worst offensive line, but also the worst passing attack in the NFL. And he really struggled. I don't know, it's really a big indictment on him as a player. Mm-hmm. And so I would certainly expect to see more of him. And it'd be, football's better when somebody like David Johnson's in a good offense. So hopefully they're able to fix things in Arizona.
Yes. Two questions for you, Chase, to finish up. Number one, if people want to check out this research on running backs, where can they do that?
They can go to footballperspective.com. It's my site. I write an article every day, post it every day, and I'm also on Twitter at FBGChase, and you can come say nice things to me there because that's what Twitter is for.
Number two. We have different Twitter experiences, apparently. Number two, describe a successful 2019 Jets season to me, the most plausible successful Jets season. What does that look like?
I do think the playoffs are plausible. And at this point, if the Jets don't make the – if they get to 9 wins and don't make the playoffs, I guess that's okay. But the Jets have been doing this for too long and building towards 2019 for too long that another poor season that doesn't end with 8 or 9 wins. You know, 8 wins should be the minimum that you would expect. Mm-hmm. And for an optimistic, plausible season, it is making the playoffs now. So the Jets sort of tore things down with the goal of rebuilding and going to 2019 and 2020. A lot of teams, including the Jets, have a history of success with a first-year head coach and the first time you bring that guy in. And so I think Jets fans can plausibly root for a playoff season.
Giants were 6-10 in 2015. They got rid of Tom Coughlin. They were 1.5 games below their Pythagorean expectation. Go on a big spending spree. They make the playoffs in 2016. The Jets fire their coach, 1.4 wins below their Pythagorean expectation last year. Go on a big spending spree. Stranger things have happened. I don't want to be on this branch with you. I don't think the Jets are going to make the playoffs, but I will say stranger things have happened than it might seem.
I don't think they will either. I will say I don't have the statistics in front of me, but the Jets, almost, maybe the last 5 head coaches made the playoffs, or in the case of Todd Bowles, almost made the playoffs in each of the years. So they've had a lot of success with, you know, Rex Ryan, Eric Mangini, Herm Edwards. So there is some history there Jets fans can be optimistic about.
Just fire the coach every year. You heard it here first from Chase Stewart of Football Perspective. Chase, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on, Bill.
All right, thanks so much to my guest today, Doug Kite of Nesson, Chase Stewart of Football Perspective. And before we go, just wanted to remind you to check out the Mina Kimes show this week. You're probably familiar with her if you read ESPN, watch ESPN, or listen to this podcast at any point in the past. This week, Mina is interviewing former Colts punter Pat McAfee, who now I believe works for the WWE, which is a strange career path, but I would recommend checking that out. And if you don't know, her podcast has a co-host. It is her dog, Lenny, who hates me, but also always asks at least one question. So highly recommend you check out the Mina Kimes show. Thanks for listening, and more on the way very soon.